Welcome back to Backbone Radio. I'm your host, Ross Kaminsky. Boy, do we have a treat for you Backbone Radio listeners this evening. We have the distinct privilege of having as our guest for the next 40 minutes or so, Wisconsin's 1st District Congressman Paul Ryan, Chairman of the House Budget Committee. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of roadmaps and budgets, I just want to mention one thing. A few people have already asked me, Ross, how did you get an interview with Paul Ryan? And the answer to that question, which I figure I'll answer now, just so I don't have to hear the question again and again, is I've known Paul for a long time. I contributed to Paul's first campaign for Congress after being involved in the very earliest days of the Club for Growth, which, again, in the first or second year of the club's operation, endorsed Paul Ryan's candidacy for Congress, one of the best decisions the club has ever made. And so Paul and I have kept in touch over the years, and for purposes of full disclosure, I should note that I have contributed to Paul's campaign or PAC more than once since then. I am a big supporter of Paul Ryan's, and he knows that I'm also not afraid to call him as I see him and offer some perhaps gentle criticism when I think he's doing it not quite the right way, but fortunately for us, given his position as chairman of the Budget Committee, he does it the right way most of the time, in my opinion. So we are very privileged to have Paul Ryan on the phone with us here at Backbone Radio, and with that, let's jump right into it. Welcome to the show, Congressman Paul Ryan. Thanks a lot for spending some time with us here on Backbone Radio today. So let me ask you, let me just start with sort of a personal question, because, you know, the first time I met you, and by the way, Chairman Ryan, how glad am I to be able to say that after the years of you and I talking about maybe one day.
I prefer Paul, as you know, but I think I met you down on the floor of the CBOE at least 10 years ago.
I think so, too. And I think the first time that I think you and I hung out together maybe was you and me and Brian Westbury at a White Sox game drinking beer.
Yeah, and I'm a Cubs fan, so I remember that, believe me. It's the only time I've ever been to a White Sox game.
I'm exactly with you on that. Now, since my first experience with you was drinking beer at a ball game and being on the trading floor of the options exchange, almost without fail, the descriptions I read of you in the media sound like the one I read in The Economist the other day, which called you the leading Republican policy wonk. It's like, Paul, you look up wonk in the dictionary now and it shows Paul Ryan. How do you feel about that?
Actually, I prefer that than anything else, I suppose. I don't really think about that stuff, to be honest. I am a policy wonk. I am kind of a geeky guy. I don't really relish politics. It's a necessary evil to put up with being able to do policy. And so, you know, I actually prefer that kind of a description because it is really who I am. It's my attitude. And it's what I prefer to do is policy. And that's what I like spending my time on it. That's where you can have a big impact in people's lives and policy. And so that's kind of it's pretty accurate, I guess I'd say.
Okay, so now,
you know, I'm kind of a policy guy.
As far as policy goes, you've spent a lot of time in the past days or past couple of weeks on listening sessions around your district explaining your budget policy ideas. I noticed as I was looking online looking for news about your listening sessions that at least one left-wing website encouraged people to go and interrupt or ask particular questions and so on. So I'm wondering how those went. How did those listening sessions go for you? Tell us a little about
that. Very well. Yeah, it's true the Democratic Party did try to have organize some demonstrations and some people to come and make a little noise. That was a very small portion of the crowds. The crowds are about 80-20 in favor of what we're talking about. You have to remember, Ross, I've already done 500 listening sessions in this district in southern Wisconsin on budget issues, on the debt, on entitlement programs. So people are used to me talking about this around here. I just did these last 19 listening sessions over the Easter period to talk about our budget, the path to prosperity, on why it's necessary to get ahead of this problem, why spending and debt is the problem, and how we can't tax our way out of this problem. And what we're proposing are, you know, real spending cuts, but more importantly, real spending reforms of our entitlement programs so that we can preempt a debt crisis, keep the size of our government limited, and keep our economy free. And we're also proposing a lot of economic growth policies to get jobs growing, to get the economy growing. So that's private sector economic growth, not government, you know, manufacturing growth.
Let me ask you a very specific question here. Again, keeping in mind the audience of this show is very politically astute, much more than your average group. What is the relationship between the 2012 budget that you proposed and your roadmap?
They're very similar. The Medicare reforms are a bit different. We propose in the budget to do a premium support system, which is similar to the Clinton Premium Support Commission, meaning their Medicare Commission. A premium support system is you select among a list of competing plans, Medicare subsidizes that plan. It works like the federal employee health benefit system. I proposed vouchers in my roadmap plan. That's a bit different. The money goes to the person, then they go buy the insurance. So the Medicare is a little different, but it is a defined contribution system. Tax reforms, they're a little bit different. I went with more of the traditional Hall-Rabushka flat tax consumption-based type of a system. What we're saying is stick with the income tax system, drop the top rates down to 25%, broaden the tax base by lowering loopholes and deductions. The other spending are very similar. They achieve similar goals as the roadmap, which is literally a plan to pay off the debt, a plan certified by the Congressional Budget Office to pay off our debt. Like the roadmap, the path to prosperity keeps our government historically limited to where it historically has been. It focuses on spending and spending controls, tax reform, and gets our debt paid off. That's contrary to the status quo. The status quo, spending literally gets out of our control. The size of government doubles within a generation, then doubles again, and our borrowing literally gets out of our control and the economy crashes. And so, like the roadmap, we prevent that from happening. This is a budget that was written by not just me, but by the Budget Committee and endorsed and supported by virtually all House Republicans. The roadmap is a plan that I wrote, which I think I had something like 13 co-sponsors on the last session. And so what I think we've been able to do is mature the Republican Party as truly the conservative party, the limited government party, the economic freedom party, and the party of fiscal responsibility and conservatism.
So within the budget and the roadmap, the politics of it is fraught with misinformation and people trying to demagogue you and misconstrue either or both plans. And I want to go through a little bit of that with you, perhaps since you started talking about the tax issue. Whenever the left is talking about this, they talk about tax. It's their talking point. Tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires. And they either mention Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or Donald Trump. So, you know, Donald Trump doesn't need a tax break. How does Paul Ryan respond to that?
Well, first of all, I'm used to the demagoguery. I've had this a lot. Second of all, class warfare, I will acknowledge, can make really good politics. Preying on people's sense of envy, fear, and emotions of anxiety can work politically, but it's really bad economics. And so they're talking about giving these people a tax cut. What they're saying is, if you're opposing our plan, like the president's plan, to raise taxes, then you're giving people a tax cut. The other language we keep hearing is, we, the government, can't afford to spend money on these tax cuts. Think about that sentence for a second. That's what we heard the president say the other day, as if this is the government's money and the government just needs to reallocate it more equitably. First of all, the money that is made in America is not the government's money. It's the person's money who made it. They pay taxes. And the way they pay taxes clearly affects the way our economy grows. It affects whether entrepreneurs can get off their feet and start and succeed, whether small businesses can become big businesses, whether American businesses can succeed in the global economy. And so what we're saying is, rather than using the tax code as some wealth redistribution tool, as some social engineering tool, let's just raise revenues efficiently for the federal government to pay the bills, and let's do it with an eye toward economic growth, toward prosperity, toward job creation. And that is why we want a tax system that is flatter, fairer, simpler, more internationally competitive, and less full of all the crony capitalistic loopholes that both parties have put in there. We don't want the tax code to be used to pick winners and losers. We want the tax code to raise revenue as efficiently as possible, to make it easier for an entrepreneur to materialize and grow, to make it easier for American businesses to compete. And also, we don't think, and I think the numbers are pretty clear about this, we don't think we should even try to tax our way out of this problem. If you do that, you'll kill the economy. Our problem with spending is so enormous that if we even try to close half of the distance, which is higher taxes, you'll shut down this economy. You will not get the kind of prosperity that we should be able to have in this country that we've had before.
I agree with you, of course, on all this. And we have about 30 seconds left in this segment. I want to ask you to respond to something, and maybe you can do it in the next segment as well. What is your gut reaction when you read, as I read in the Washington Times, a report that said April's federal budget deficit was lower than expected because April's tax receipts were higher than expected, and now I'm quoting, despite the tax deal in April that kept the Bush budget cuts in place. Tell you what, Congressman Paul Ryan, hold your answer for a few seconds when we come back after this break. Paul Ryan will answer that very question. Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio. Welcome back to Backbone Radio. We are, of course, most pleased and privileged to have Congressman Paul Ryan, who I will call Paul during this conversation.
Thanks, Ross.
Although Mr. Chairman sounds good to me, too. So before the break, Paul, I asked you, what comes into your mind? What's your gut reaction when you hear, you know, the media or politicians say, as they are, for example, about higher than expected tax revenue in April being despite the deal in December to extend the Bush tax cuts?
They've never met Art Laffer. look, I'm so used to this. We hear this all the time. There's just this belief that sort of the economic pie is fixed, and it's just a question of government redistributing its slices. There's never really a thought of growing the pie, and the tax rates on the margin affect that. And so when we had the agreement with the president to keep taxes where they are, we knew this would help grow the economy. The president did not want to do this, did it, and is now promising to undo it. And what has happened? By removing this big threat of this tax increase for the next 2 years from entrepreneurs and successful small businesses, they're able to grow and prosper and reinvest. The economy grows more. People are recognizing more income. We get more revenue from the top 1% since the 2003 tax cuts than when we did. They actually share a larger burden of the tax, income tax burden, than they did when they had higher tax rates. Why? Because of more economic activity, better, more income tax being paid, more tax compliance. And so, again, history does teach us lots of lessons. And the lesson that tells you about revenue growth is it's not tied to whether tax rates are really high or not. It's tied to whether we grow our economy well or not. And the best way to grow the economy is to keep our tax rates low.
So let me ask you a question, and I asked the same question of Senator Mike Lee when I had a chance to talk with him, and just wondering personally how it figures into how you think about things, and that is the morality of the system, the morality of the idea that almost 50% of Americans pay no income tax, or that the top 1% of Americans pays 40% of the income tax. I mean, how important is this question of morality to you versus the more pragmatic questions of what levels of tax rates get the most revenue and so on?
It's what is primary to me. The morality of this, and I talk about this a lot. I'm exchanging letters with Archbishop Dolan of New York on this very point. The morality of this is the primary concern to me, because what I worry about is we're becoming a welfare state like European society, where the majority of our citizens become dependent upon the government for their livelihoods rather than upon themselves. And if we reach a tipping point where too many people see the government as their supplier, not themselves, then we've crossed that tipping point. We've lost America as we know it. I believe, from a moral standpoint, that the role and goal of government should be toward to protect our equal natural rights, promote equal opportunity, and be defined by the characteristics of upward mobility and prosperity. That's quite different than what we get from the left, which is that the role of government ought to equalize the results of our lives. So instead of equal opportunity, we pursue equal outcomes in the name of equity. And that is contrary to human nature. What it does is it lulls able-bodied people into lives of complacency and dependency and drains them of their incentive and their will to make the most of their lives. And as a result, societies stagnate, societies decline. We don't grow as well. We don't prosper as much. And that, to me, is the ending of the American idea if we allow that to sink in too much. And that, of all things, to me, is the real consequence of this fiscal fight we're having here in Washington.
You know, I don't want to spend too much time on it because I want to get into nuts and bolts of Medicare with you, but I don't remember the last time I heard a congressman, or if I've ever heard a congressman before, mention natural rights. And I'm very impressed. I mean, give us 30 seconds on your conception of natural rights and why it's important in politics.
Well, just read the Declaration. I can do a better job than I can describe it. Our rights come from nature and God, not from government. And it's just that simple. I always look to our founding documents if you want to get a good sense for natural rights, for natural law. But the debate we're having these days in Washington, and look, I come from Wisconsin, right near Madison, where the Progressive Party was founded in Wisconsin, or which went to the rest of the country. And, you know, I've read Hegel and I've read Weber and Bismarck and all of the thinkers of those times who sort of defined this sort of thinking, which is rights now need to be manufactured and created and given to us by government. And if that's the case, and I hear this about healthcare all the time, then it is government's right to define these things for us in our lives. It is government's right to ration these things, to regulate these things, to redistribute these things. And what it does is it sort of cheapens, diminishes these things in our lives, whether it be healthcare or energy or whatnot. And that gives government a lot of power. That means government has to have a large government of unelected bureaucrats who are really making the primary decisions in our lives versus we, the people, making these decisions for our own lives. It's basically a classic difference of, is the individual the nucleus of our economy or is it the government? I believe it's the individual. I believe that's what America was founded upon, that recognition, that we have these, that our natural rights are to be protected, so long as we're not infringing upon another person's rights to do the same. And unfortunately, we have a political philosophy that has dominated Washington for many years and is in the forefront of this president's mind, is to basically turn that off, consider it obsolete, outdated, and come on with this new sort of vision, which has been around for about 100 years, of having the government create these rights and therefore regulate these aspects of our society. To me, that's decline. That's stagnation. That's managed decline. That's a European welfare state. And what that looks like at the end of the road is basically a debt crisis and austerity, and I want to avoid that.
Well, I'd like to offer a hallelujah, Brother Paul, to that. Now, one of the biggest, you know, false charges against your budget and your roadmap, and what I think will be the biggest political hurdle in getting any of this done, is of course Medicare. One of my favorite columnists, Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. I don't know if you know her, but she's got an article out today entitled "Banking on Medicare," and it talks about you and the Democrats' reaction to your policy. Is it about, you know, Medicare as a strategy that has worked for Democrats before? And Selena asks rhetorically, will it work again? What's your answer to that?
I don't think so. I've been running on these things for years. I've been running on Medicare reform like this for at least 5 years now. And I have a district that went for, you know, Dukakis, Clinton, Gore, and Obama. And I do fine. So I do believe if you can go out and explain it to people, they're fine. And more importantly, the reason I think we haven't addressed these entitlement problems is because to the person or the party who does so, they're giving their political opponent a weapon to use against them, an ability to distort and demagogue, to use it against them in the next election. And then that puts fear into that politician, and they don't do it. Well, we can't do that anymore. We can't keep going down this path of rewarding politicians who keep making empty promises to people. We have to get back onto a system of rewarding the political leader who's just candid about where we are and has solutions. Now, they will do the Medicare. We're basically saying don't change the benefits for people in and near retirement, but to save these programs, you've got to change the way they work. And I would rather have a more personalized Medicare system where the beneficiary gets to make the choice, gets to choose among competing private plans for their business versus the president's alternative. And this is the one area where he has put out an alternative. And that is this new board his law creates called the IPAB, Independent Payment Advisory Board. It's 15 people he appoints starting next year, and he gives them targets, spending cut targets. He's moved it to almost $1 trillion now. He keeps changing their target to just indiscriminately go through and impose price controls on Medicare. That is the whole thinking behind his version of health care reform. Delegate to bureaucrats the management and running of this, one of the most complicated, sophisticated sectors of our economy, and these 15 people will figure out how to run it better than we possibly could in a competitive environment, where resources are being competed for and our business is won by the best provider.
Paul,
I just don't agree with that.
You'll recognize that as someone who reads a lot. You will recognize that as what Hayek called the fatal conceit.
Yeah, I'm a big Hayek fan.
When we come back, I want to ask you about the morality of Medicare as it is, as long as we're talking about morality. Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio. Welcome back to Backbone Radio, again joined by Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan, chairman of the House Budget Committee. And as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, I contributed to Paul's very first campaign to Congress, and for purposes of full disclosure, have contributed to his campaign or PAC more than once since then. And we were talking about Medicare and, of course, the idea that Democrats will try to demagogue the issue. And, Paul, it seems to me you've made it very clear that people who are in or near retirement, nothing's going to change for them.
Right.
And it seems to me that not just you, Paul Ryan, but lots of Republicans use the rhetoric that, okay, we need to change the plan so that it remains solvent for people later. And you're probably used to getting questions from the left along the lines of, you know, Paul, why do you hate old sick people?
Right.
But my question for you is going to be very different. It is, why is it moral for government to pay for anybody's health care, or at least any essentially able-bodied person?
So the morality of this particular issue is the government made a big promise, is an empty one, but a big promise to people. And people retired around that promise. So take a 75-year-old today, a 65-year-old, a 58-year-old today, and their lives, their livelihoods, and their entire retirement system were planned around this promise that government made to them. Now, put aside the fact whether it's a funded or unfunded promise, it was a promise. And our point is, look, this promise can't be kept in the future. It's going bankrupt, and it's bankrupting this country. Medicare is the biggest driver of national bankruptcy. And so we're saying if we act now, before a debt crisis hits us, we can keep the promise that was made to the people who organized their lives around it, so they don't have to reorganize their lives. Government has to reorganize its policies. But the way in order to do that is to go to a system, a defined contribution kind of a system, where government gives finite resources to people on the future of Medicare, and it supports those who have the least and gives less support to people who have the most, meaning it's a safety net system that helps people get guaranteed coverage when they retire. But the reason, and I've been asked, well, why don't you balance the budget tomorrow? You could do that, but the reason we don't do that is because we think a promise that was made to these people should be kept. And the more important thing is we think the government can keep that promise if we reform the way the government works going forward.
And I agree with you completely on the promises that have been made to people. But let's say to, you know, I'm 45, and you and I think are pretty close to the same age.
Yeah.
You know, for people our age and younger, wouldn't it be more moral for the government to get out of it entirely, and slowly phase out the Medicare tax, just whittle it down over time so that it pays for current retirees, but make people more responsible for their own health care, just the
right.
same so, way you and I think they should be more responsible for their own retirement.
This is an area where maybe we will disagree. This is an area where I do think government involvement is helpful and is moral, which is a pure laissez-faire system is a system where without guardrails in which those who are able-bodied still may not be able to succeed. And I do believe that the government does have a role in helping set up systems, markets, so that we can get the things we need in our lives, such as high priorities in our lives like health care. And I do believe the government can help organize marketplaces with real transparency, with real competition, so that we can maximize these goals in our lives, getting ourselves health care. And I do believe, though, that it should be patient-centered, individually driven reforms, not government-run systems. And given the fact that we already dedicate, more than 2.5 times per person on spending on health care than any other industrialized country does, raising more taxes and spending more money is really not the answer. A lot of the money goes to third payers, either through employers or through governments. I would simply say let people have this money back in the first place. So the money that is spent in healthcare is run to the individual using their money and into a marketplace that is set up to work, a marketplace that has transparency on price, on quality, and economic incentive to act on those things. Reapplying free market principles into the healthcare sector with the kinds of extra assistance to those in need the most, I think, is a smarter way to go. I think it is a moral way to do it, and I do believe that the government does have a role to play in this area.
So, you know, I guess you and I can agree to disagree, you know, a little bit on that in the sense of I'm yet to see evidence, and maybe you have some, of where government has set up a really good, effective, competitive market. But I do think we can agree that right now government is preventing competition in healthcare,
major
such as
distortions.
The fact
That's
that you
right.
can't buy healthcare across state lines. Don't you think that needs to be one of the first things
That's
to change?
That's what I mean when I say that, is government can break down barriers across state lines. I'm a believer in risk pools. I think state-based high-risk pools to help assist individuals with pre-existing conditions get affordable care is a smart policy. It's market-based, and it's something that the government can play a constructive role in helping assemble. But it's a marketplace. Exchange across state lines is, purchasing across state lines is one of those seminal reforms I've been in favor of all along. It's been in our bills from the get-go. And again, just like we have transparency in pricing in other markets where you can get real price discovery, you don't have that in the healthcare sector. That is something that I think government can play a constructive role in, not setting prices and not publishing the metrics, but in seeing about a system where we have real price discovery, because we can find out what things cost in healthcare, who's good, who's bad, what are the best outcomes, what's the best quality, so we can act as better informed consumers when we go shop for our healthcare.
Right. I mean, no doubt one of the biggest problems in our healthcare system today and drivers of healthcare inflation is the disconnect between who's paying for healthcare and who's
That's
receiving
right.
it. It's a big
And
problem.
That is something that government, I think, can help fix. It's hurting it right now. It's making it harder. And removing those barriers, removing those things, I think is something that is constructive.
So getting back to Mediscare and your listening sessions, tell us a little bit about how it went in your sessions, if you could perhaps break it down by age group. Like, what was your response from senior citizens versus what was the response from younger people, at least people who you thought weren't daily coast plants, about Medicare?
We obviously had these plants, but and I'm used to it, and I call on the plants. I intentionally try to do so because I want to hear their arguments as well and discuss those things. Overwhelmingly positive. We really think, just from looking at crowd responses, there are about 80-20 in favor, and there are clearly, I come from a mixed political area. People are just suspicious all the way around about Republicans and everything else, but there are also some organized opposition. But as soon as you walk people through, I have a 20-minute PowerPoint I go through. If you walk people through the facts of the budget and through the ration and the reason that you apply to fixing this problem, the vast majority of people are enthusiastic. The vast majority of people are supportive. We had record crowds. We had to move to bigger venues like high school auditoriums and gymnasiums in order to accommodate these massive crowds. I did 19 of these town hall meetings. They were overwhelmingly positive. To me, they were very motivational. I mean, I really got a good pump out of these things because it told me that my employers, the people of the First District of Wisconsin, are telling me I'm on the right track, that they want to see leaders get in there, roll up their sleeves, and go fight to fix this stuff. And even though there's going to be demagogue, even though there's going to be distortion. And what I spend a lot of my time in the beginning doing is just clearing up all the distortions that are out there. You know, senior citizens in my district have been hit with phone calls, radio ads, and television ads, basically trying to scare them into thinking that I'm trying to take away their Medicare. And so once you dispel people of this distortion, explain what it is you're trying to do, and how you're trying to save the country from a debt crisis, from massive tax increases and a slower economy, people are pretty supportive of that idea.
Yeah, perhaps you won't be surprised to hear that the little bit of news about your listening sessions that made it out here to Colorado were the few clips of, you know, some irate senior citizen, apparently irate senior citizen yelling at you.
Yeah, so there were, I forgot the name of the liberal group that did that, but there were a number of other media outlets that filmed the same listening sessions and showed the standing ovations I received going into the room and standing ovations I received going out of the room from at least 80% of the crowd. Even Christiane Amanpour on ABC filmed and showed on TV two of the standing ovations we received. So there are a lot of groups out there. The Weekly Standard did some filming of this. The MacGyver Institute here in Wisconsin, it's one of our think tanks here, showed full videos that showed anything but what the Daily Coast or the Think Progress, I can't remember the name of these groups, were trying to contradict.
Interesting. So
we're used to that, though.
We have about a minute and a half left in this segment. Can I have you for just a few more minutes after this segment?
Let me look. 2:40. Mm-hmm. They're telling me I get going in a few minutes here.
Okay, let me ask you just a couple of very quick things here. A couple people have wondered, including me, although I think I have a guess at the answer, as to why your 2012 budget was silent on Social Security. Could you address that?
Well, first of all, we actually thought we had a chance at an agreement with the President and the Senate this summer on this issue. And we felt, number one, if we put a plan out there, it would be too tempting for Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi not to demagogue. It'd make it harder for us to get an agreement to fix the problem. We put a trigger in our budget which says if it's insolvent and the trustees certified of that, which they would, then that requires the House and the Senate and the White House to submit plans and then to have a fast track to get a plan on the table. So what we're trying to do is move the ball forward to do Social Security reform and bring solvency to the program, and we thought this was the best way to get that. Now, since we've done our budget, the amount of demagoguery we're getting from everybody makes it less likely, in my opinion, that we're going to get an agreement on this, but we still believe we want to do that. We thought of all issues, healthcare is so different because of the things you and I just discussed, that Social Security is the one entitlement program which we think we could have a solution to. The Fiscal Commission was close. It wasn't quite there, but it was almost there to a plan that people like me would have supported. I didn't like the tax increases. That was my big sticking point.
Now, Paul, I have to hit a break. I'm sorry, I have to hit a break here. We're going to be back in just a few moments. We'll wrap it up with Congressman Paul Ryan. Stay with us through these words. Welcome back to Backbone Radio, our last couple of minutes with Congressman Paul Ryan. Paul, before we hit the break, you were talking about the Fiscal Commission and Social Security. Why don't you continue with that for a moment?
Yeah, so we believe that Social Security reform, A, if we did that, it would help us with the credit markets. B, we think it's easier to accomplish given the bipartisan nature of divided government, and that it would be a worthy accomplishment. It would help with the credit markets. It would help put this program on a path to solvency, and it's an easier problem to fix just from a technical standpoint. Unfortunately, though, we're getting the kind of demagoguery from the other side that even that might be fleeting and escaping us. But that was where our intentions were in writing our budget.
Okay. And in the last couple minutes we have left here, Larry Kudlow wrote an interesting piece a couple days ago for Real Clear Markets, part of Real Clear Politics, and it's entitled, Will Republicans Man Up for Pro-Growth Reforms? And he's questioning whether some of your colleagues will, you know, stick with your pro-growth message and your path here. What's your take on the politics of this within the Republican caucus?
You know, there's a bit of green eye shade, but what people like me are trying to do is say you can't do all of this without growth, and we've got to focus on it. I'm giving a speech at the Chicago Economic Club next week about growth, and I'm going to be talking about this. Our budget is called The Path to Prosperity for a reason. It is pro-growth economics, not just tax reform. We also, you don't do this in budgets, but we also need to have sound money, and I'm going to talk about that a lot more these days. But also we have an energy policy where we drill for our own oil and gas. There are a lot of pro-growth things we can and should do. Regulatory reform, sound money, spending cuts and controls, tax reform. Those are the pro-growth policies that we put in this budget. Some that are not in this budget we're going to be talking about because they don't belong in a fiscal document. And we do need to get ourselves back on offense on pro-growth. We think this budget was a good step in the right direction, but that's not enough. You got to keep pushing, and I'm going to be doing that.
And my last question for you, Congressman Paul Ryan, on Intrade.com, where people like me can and do bet on politics, a guy named Paul Ryan is trading about 1% to be the 2012 Republican nominee for president. Is that too low, too high, or about right?
1%, huh? Okay,
1%.
Well, those are the odds. That sounds about right.
All right. As the last time I think I asked you that question, you said both your ego and your children were too small for you to run for president
right now. That's right.
Which I thought
still feel
was
the same way.
Well, very good. Paul Ryan, thank you so much for taking time out of your day. I know you're a busy guy, much in demand. Thanks for being with us
here.
Hey,
you bet. I love Colorado. I've I'm 38 14ers there, and I'm going to come back this summer and do some more.
Well, next time you do, let us know. Maybe you can join us in studio for a while, and I can buy you another beer, but not at a White Sox game this time.
Yeah, all right. Take it easy.
All right, thank you. That was Republican Congressman Paul Ryan from the 1st Congressional District of Wisconsin, chairman of the House Budget Committee. As I told you, I've known Paul a long time. I think he is one of the good guys, and I know a lot of Republicans like to criticize him for this or that vote that he's made. But at the end of the day, this is a guy who is a champion for free markets, for economic liberty, and for morality. I mean, I was so pleased to hear him answer just then with the inclusion of natural rights in his answer. And when do you hear that from a politician? And how many American politicians even know what natural rights are? I mean, when Nancy Pelosi was asked whether Obamacare was unconstitutional or whether it was constitutional, her response to the question was, "Are you serious?" She meant was, "Are you serious that that's even an important question?" Paul Ryan gets it, and I understand that we can disagree around the edges on this and that, but at the end of the day, this guy is a champion. He's exactly what we need in Congress, and we should be very, very thankful that Paul Ryan is there fighting for us each and every day. I hope you've enjoyed this interview of Paul Ryan. I certainly have, and it's been great to finally get him on the air, an interview I've been trying to land for a while, but of course, he's been a little bit busy.